So he's not out of date at all. And what he has to say is very interesting. It's a challenge for us to find alternative excavations. And clearly, with new techniques, we've been able to do that. He also was very early on talking about children's understanding of knowledge of mental processes, mental states. I spent some time talking about that. The development in the preschool years. And clearly that's a very hot topic at the moment. So children's understanding of other people's thoughts, beliefs, intentions, how they come to interpret what's going on around them, is a major research topic at the moment. And you can trace that right back to Piaget. Nobody else has started looking at this until Piaget carried out his interviews with children. You know, what do you think with your ears, your eyes, your mouth, and so on? All those curious interviews. That's where all this research is coming from. He also carried out a huge amount of work on development of thinking and reasoning. We just touched on a little bit, okay? There's much, much more. But I don't want to overload you. I just want to give you a feel of the discoveries that he made and what he thought was happening, the changes taking place, and some of the new research. Read more about this in the textbook. You should have some idea of what he was looking at there. So all that research can be traced back directly to Piaget. He kicked off that whole line of inquiry, which is, again, a very hot topic today. And finally, specific area is this concept of conservation. The development of logical processes which underpin children's knowledge of what is going on in the world around them. Okay, that was pure Piaget. He invented that. He was the first to make these discoveries. Interesting, it's a great funny that it's a long time ago, but a Mrs. G. Piaget wrote a letter to the courier from Lockheed, pointing out that she made a curious observation that her little girl, when she poured her juice from one glass to another, thought suddenly there was more in it. And she was very impressed by this observation, wanted the readers of the Courier, the Dundee Courier, had also seen similar things to their children. We don't think it was the ghost of Piaget, right? It's a pervasive observation. It's very solid, you see it in all children, and it clearly marks the stage of their development, but what's the question is when this has happened. Now the other interesting thing he did was he provided very clear criteria for achieving these abilities. For example, I talked about the development of mental representations in infancy. Okay, spent some time looking at that. He actually gave us several very clear criteria so we could be certain that a baby has this competence. Okay? Delayed attention, remember what that is. If you see that, that's very good evidence for a representational capacity. Planning ahead to solve problems. Delayed imitation, I mentioned that. Obviously also language and pretend play. All these are very, very clear examples. And then searching for objects which have been hidden invisibly, where you have to mentally work out the route taken by the object. You never see where it was actually hidden. You have to make an inference. Very, very clear evidence. So, you know, he's given us quite a good service in giving us these criteria. Remember yesterday I talked about deductive reasoning, his sharp observation that you can only demonstrate an understanding of reasoning once children can reason with false information, counterfactual information, not relying on knowledge they already bring to the situation. So there's a whole range of these criteria that he was absolutely right about and we still use today. And many of his findings have been replicated. His observations are extremely good. So don't get the impression that what he's reporting is incorrect. You can go to pub-based nursery down the road, to the school, to the primary school, and you could test the children in exactly the same way as Piaget tested them back in the 50s and 60s, and you would see exactly the same behavior, you'd get exactly the same results. Of course, the problem is, do we interpret what's going on in the same way? Now, obviously, many of his claims aren't supported by later research. And one reason is that we've got available this whole battery of new techniques for getting detailed information about what infants can and can't do. For example, the violation of expectation paradigm. Now, Patient Piaget played tricks on his children. For example, he had a little trick box and would hide something in it, and something else would be discovered when the child opened the lid and reached inside. But generally, he just had to rely on what he could see was happening, and then improvise by varying situations, hiding a toy at B after hiding it at A, and so on. Now we have a whole range of technology to tell us how long babies are looking at events, and we can use differences in looking times to interpret what's going on. We have new methods for testing older children. I pointed out some of the problems with Piaget methods. For example, interrogation, the questioning that he often did, by giving children leading questions and often very confusing questions, asking them, well, what does it mean to think? You know, how do you answer that? It's hard enough for us to answer it, let alone if you're 7 or 8 years of age. We have to use other techniques to draw out evidence that children have or don't have various abilities. So, representation in infancy, that's one of the big claims he made, that babies don't have this capacity. It's the end product of infancy and marks the entrance to the next stage of development. Our current views are that, in fact, some ability for representation is present in the newborn. It's the starting point. Remember Melsoff's work on imitation of facial gestures, facial expressions. Exactly. Very young babies can remember something that was modeled the day before and can imitate it and copy it 24 hours later. Very strong evidence that they have this capacity for early imitation. Actually, Piaget was completely unfazed by these observations. He was still alive when Melsoff published his first study on newborn imitation, and in response to the comment that when you stick your tongue out for the newborn baby, the baby will stick its tongue out by imitating you, copying you, he actually simply said, oh, how rude. And he was kind of an arrogant person. I guess, you know, at the end of a career this long, this influential, he could afford to be. There is an arrogance, though, and one of his problems is that he had his theory all worked out before he went collecting his evidence. He didn't use the evidence to test his theory. And that is one of the criticisms. So he actually stuck to his views and interpreted the data he got. And often when it didn't quite fit, he just set it aside. He left it alone. So, you know, it wasn't really a careful exponent of the scientific method that we adopt today. I guess that's one of the reasons why we find so many discrepancies. We also saw, in the case of egocentric thinking in the preschool years, that evidence has now changed. There's a shift of emphasis. You can demonstrate egocentric thinking, the sort Piaget described, but it disappears in many different areas quite early on. It's not persistent. It's not a pervasive characteristic. So there is some evidence to back up his claims, but it's not nearly as strong as he thought it was. And also we looked at just one other example of deductive reasoning. I talked about that yesterday. And he was claiming that a true, genuine understanding, ability to reason deductively, to make inferences, emerges very late in development. And in fact, we've seen evidence that you can show it wasn't much, much earlier. So, a lot of new evidence doesn't really support Piaget's stages. The problems are, there are some abilities present too early. They're there out of sequence. But therefore, the child has had the necessary experience to generate and produce these abilities. So there's something wrong with his account there. So we don't get clear evidence of the stages in many situations. Like I've talked about a lot of examples, but all of these examples here provide that evidence. The second thing is we don't see abrupt changes from one stage to the next. Development now looks much more gradual. There have been some attempts to describe the stages in different ways, but our current view about development is that it's much more piecemeal. It's not nearly as integrated as Piaget claimed. And you get development in some areas and children lagging behind, the same children lagging behind in others. It's much more piecemeal and haphazard. We don't get this clearer sharp boundaries and sharp statements. But one of the biggest problems with Piaget is that he didn't recognize that there is a difference between measuring children's competence and their performance. And what he thought he was doing with his text, it's very clear, he thought this, when you read his observations, you read his reports, he really thought that when he tested children and he recorded their behavior, their answers, their errors, and so on, he was assessing their competence. He was actually seeing what they could do, what they knew, and what they understood. And we no longer hold that view, because we now understand, I'm going to give you some examples, we now understand clearly that a child may have some ability. It may be a little fragile, it may not be fully formed, it can be there. But very often, when you test the children, you don't see this ability coming out. So there are performance factors that interfere, that prevent the child displaying everything that he or she can do. Now, if you think back through the various lectures, I've given a number of examples, instances of where this occurs. I gave some yesterday. Remember the modifications to the conservation tasks. Now, if you test children in the way Piaget did, you know, you set out a juice, does this have more, does this have more, or are they the same? You get exactly the answers Piaget described. At roughly the same ages, and in children from different cultures, different countries. So you can replicate what he observed. But Piaget's mistake was he thought that was their competence. The children who gave incorrect answers didn't have any concept of conservation. It's only when they start giving correct answers and can explain their reasoning, justify them, that he believed they had developed this competence. But now we find if you ask a question only once, a lot of kids will give you correct answers. They've got this ability, it's there, but the way they understand or they interact with you, the way they understand your question interferes with displaying that ability. They have a competence, but their performance doesn't reveal that competence. And Piaget never took that on board. And I think that's one of the big mistakes that he made. Another example I gave yesterday was counterfactual reasoning. That's a very clear instance. Sit down, ask children these questions in a matter-of-fact way. Even four-year-olds. Rex is a cat, can Rex bark? Rex is a cat, can Rex bark? And four-year-olds will say, no, because my cat goes meow. Okay, they deny it. Now, for Piaget, that is a failure of reasoning. These kids cannot reason, because they can't reason with this material. However, tell them we're going to pretend to an imaginary planet, or get them to think about green pigs floating through the air, and then ask the question, and the answer is different. They give a correct answer, and what's more, they begin to justify it. They can explain their reasoning. So a dramatic difference there. Their performance, as measured by Piaget's methods, doesn't always reveal the underlying competence. There's a gap. And there's been a huge amount of research into why we get these differences. What are the problems? What is it that's going on? I'm just going to give you a little bit of information, okay, on one of the current red-hot topics in developmental psychology. The development of what are known as executive. These are mental cognitive processes involved in controlling behavior and controlling thinking. So they're very extensive, both mental processes and physical behavior that are involved in executive function. Let me just give you a little demonstration, okay? Just to bring home how problematic it can be controlling behavior. So if you just put pens down for a moment, okay? Right? Now, take your right hand and put it on top of your head. Okay? And what I want you to do is just tap your head. This is great. I always wanted to do this for the second year class, and now I've got it. No, let's carry on. Okay, right. Okay, stop that. Now, take the left hand and put it on your tummy. And, oh yeah, you're thinking about jelly ice cream and, you know, some kid throwing a tantrum with a coffee. Okay. Right, now, right hand on your head, left hand on your tummy, and I want you to do both actions at the same time. It's a wonderful sight. You look perfect. Okay, great, great. I guess Jenny can do it, but you have to think a bit, right? It's a little bit tricky. With children, it's a real problem. You know, often one activity spills over into the other. So, you know, you end up tapping everything or rubbing everything, and or you break it up. You do one, and then the other. One, then the other. Okay? This activity, doing two things, different things simultaneously, puts a big strain on our executive functions, particular planning functions, and ability to inhibit incorrect behavior. Correct behavior with the hand was tapping, correct behavior with this hand was circular motion. So you've got to inhibit making a circular motion with this hand and inhibit tapping with this one. You always, when we're thinking and we're doing things, we're not just selecting behavior and performing it, we're also stopping doing other things. That's a crucial part of our mental and physical activity. And that is the crucial executive function, inhibitory control. There are a number of these functions, planning ahead, organizing mental processes, that's an executive function, and using working memory, a little sketch pad where you just temporarily hold on to information and then get rid of it to hold on to new information. Okay, that is an executive function. So there are several of these, and a key function is inhibitory control. Controlling attention, ignoring, distracting, interfering information that can get in the way of giving correct answers for your thinking. Now, what's interesting is these executive functions, very good evidence, which I'm not going to go into, are mediated by one area of the brain, the frontal cortex. And that area of the brain is very interesting from a developmental perspective, because it's the very last region of cortex to develop. It's extremely immature in newborns, and it only really begins to develop around 4, 5, 6 months of age. That's when you really see synapses forming, connections between cells, myelination. The development of frontal cortex carries on throughout childhood. It's not only the last area of cortex to develop, but its development is extremely slow. And in fact, it's not properly mature until probably the end of adolescence. So there's a development here which is spread out throughout childhood. And here we're talking about all these processes which are involved in controlling thinking, regulating thinking, and in particular, inhibiting attention, ignoring distractions. And it's become clear that it's often the case that one reason why you don't always see a child's competence, that their performance falls below their competence, is that in the test situation, they're getting distracted, and especially if they're young, it's because they have poor executive control, poor inhibitory control. So improvements occur once frontal cortex is developed, not necessarily when they've developed the underlying competence. So it could well be that a lot of the observations Piaget made occurred in older children because these children were very good at ignoring, interfering, distracting information that's present when he was testing the kids. Here's a classic test of ability to inhibit interfering information which you can give to adults. It's known as a strip test after the psychologist, that's the name of the psychologist who first devised it in the 1930s. And it's a horrible task, it really is. You know, you get a whole load of these names, and your task is to ignore the colour word and focus on the colour of the ink. You're supposed to name the colour of the ink. So the correct response here is green, not blue. But because reading is such an automatic process, you can't avoid processing the name, and that interferes with your response. You've got two colour words, blue, green, and what happens is it slows you up. Typically with adults, it slows up, makes it some longer to produce the correct response. And that is the frontal cortex inhibiting the incorrect response and allowing the correct one to be made. You can show this slowing by testing individuals on examples where there's no conflict. So here, the word reads red and the colour of the ink is red. Bang, you give the answer very fast. But this one, give the correct answer, there's a slowing up. It's very easy to measure. You also get these curious errors, like bleeding here, where one word was spilled into the other one. Now what's interesting is, you can give this test to children once they've had a couple of years of literacy. So from about 7 years, provided they can read the colour words, then you can give this test, and you find there is a steady improvement from 7 up to 12 years of age when they begin to approach adult-like levels of performance on this test. So clearly, this is tracking the development of the prefrontal cortex, the ability to ignore, inhibit interfering information. Interestingly, you can give similar tests for kids younger than 7, and recently, there have been a whole rash of these that appeared. Psychologists have been developing these sorts of assessments. And they are very useful. Here's a very nice one. This is the Daylight test. It's developed by Adele Diamond, who we discussed earlier, with her explanation for the AMP error. So you have these two colours. Here you've got the moon and stars on black background. Here you've got the sun on white background. And the child is told, whenever you see this, here's what you say. Day. And whenever you see this, this is what you say. Night. And you can see the problem here. The picture on the card, like the word, is leading the child to say something different, which is in conflict with the correct response. So that's a picture of night, the correct response is day. This is a picture of day, the correct response is night. And it's absolutely clear that when you start testing kids as young as 3.5, you can test them on this, they have quite a lot of difficulty. They start reasonably well, and then the effort of inhibiting attention and ignoring this conflicting information gives out. Their frontal cortex is mature enough to maintain that inhibition, and they start producing lots of mistakes. So, we've got an elegant way here of testing the development of inhibitory control from about 3.5 up to 6. About 6.5 is when performance begins to peak on this test. And here's a really interesting result. There's been a whole bunch of these studies now looking at the links between this development of inhibitory control, executive function, and performance on other developmental tests, particularly performance on tests of theory of mind. Remember the Sally Ann task that I described last week. So in the study, this is Stephanie Carlson and Moses. They studied children aged 3 to 4 years of age. Okay? And remember the 3-year-olds. Really can't keep track. They get misled. They believe that Anne, who's placed her marble in the basket, and she goes, Sally or Anne, I can't remember. Sally, because Sally put her marble in the basket with. Goes out of the room, so she will have a belief that the marble is in the basket, okay? Meanwhile, Anne takes the marble, puts it in the box, Sally comes back. Where does the child think the marble? Sorry, where does the child think Sally will look for a marble? 3-year-olds say she'll look in the box, even though she really believes it's in the basket. Now, my explanation is that this is a problem of inhibitory control, ignoring, overriding, distracting information. And sure enough, when you test children across this age range, you find a significant positive correlation between their performance of Sally Ann's belief task and the day-night task. So children who get more correct answers on day 9, who've got better inhibitory control, can ignore distractions better, give more correct answers on these kind of false belief tasks, suggesting that there's no correlation, but it does suggest strongly that there's a link. And interestingly, the correlation can be adjusted. You can take out of the correlation any contribution of age. Then obviously, older children do better on everything because they're developing more. Maybe there's no connection between inhibition and fear in my understanding. It's just because both improve in older children. But we can remove that component from the correlation. There are techniques which allow you to do that. We can also remove differences in their IQ, their verbal IQ. And even when you do that, this is the correlation that remains. So it's pretty strong evidence that there is some link here. And so this is the problem. The three-year-olds, if you ask them, know the marble was here. They know where it was. Remember those knowledge questions that the kids get? Where was the marble, first of all? Basket, they know that. Where is it now in the box? They know that. But the problem for a three-year-old who has poor executive function, who can't inhibit paying attention to things that are really serious, is we're asking them to think about Anne's mental state, what she believes. Okay? No, sorry, Sally's mental state. But at the same time, they've just seen the marble placed in the box. They know it's there. It's very salient. It grabs their attention. If they're asked to search for the marble, they know exactly where to go for it. Okay? So the interpretation here is that we've got these two ideas in competition. The child may well have some understanding that Sally believes the marble is here, but they can't think about that because their attention is directed strongly to the place where the marble is. And because of their poor executive function, they cannot inhibit this very salient location. And that's why they give the incorrect answers. Four-year-olds, on the other hand, have moved on. They do better on the daylight test. They've got better inhibitory control. Now they can ignore this location much better. And they can control their thinking and give the correct answer, which is the Sally who looked in the original place. It's a very interesting explanation. And if you look at a number of Piaget's demonstrations, you can begin to see that the same explanation might apply. That in his tests, children's attention may be directed very strongly to the incorrect information. Here's another example. I've covered this already. This is a very good example of this, the use of this approach. This is Diana's work on the A of B error. And she's arguing here, contrary to Piaget, babies do retain a memory of where the toy is on the B drawing. Okay? Piaget denied that, but I gave you evidence that they can remember where the toy is, even after being distracted for 70 seconds. They remember where it is. But, so, you know, they've got the competence, but the trouble is their poor inhibitory control produces a performance that doesn't reveal that competence. There is a distinction between the two. And they reach back to A because they cannot inhibit their behavior. Their prefrontal cortex is too immature. So here we've got, again, these pictures I showed you from Diana. This is a B trial. This is a little girl, 9-month-old, showing that she has the competence, okay, looking in the right direction. In fact, she's got a hand up, so yes, she's come a long way, but her performance lets her down. She reaches for the other hand, she can't inhibit doing what she did a moment ago, and reaches back and picks up the incorrect block. So it's a really nice demonstration of this gap between competence and performance. And that was a gap Piaget didn't entertain. He thought performance equals competence, and we now think very differently for these reasons. And development of executive function is one possible explanation. So I've heard a reference, a bit about this in the Bjorken text, so if you want to read a bit more about this, then in, I can't remember now, it's chapter 5, it's just a short section, it's about 4 or 5 pages, where you can read a little bit more about these tests and the explanations that we theories that are coming out of this line of research. More about this next year when we get laboratory developmental psychology. So just to recap on the main topics that I've covered, just to refresh your memory so you've got a clearer picture to hold in mind all at the same time. We started out looking at these studies of visual information processing. I did that deliberately to give you a feel of where these new techniques have come from, how straightforward and simple they are, and as a background to the more sophisticated violation of expectation techniques in infancy, which can give us information about infants' cognition. So you're familiar with these topics now, you're writing an essay, and I'll be working on a practical report, so I won't say too much about that. But I will make one interesting point, and I want to emphasize this, because people get a little bit confused and muddled about this, okay? Piaget's theory, Piaget claimed, wrongly, but he claimed, infants don't have mental representations, okay? But he wasn't saying that they don't have memory, all right? Let's just be clear. What he means by lacking mental symbolic representation, he means that although they can lay down information in memory, they can recognize things, and he understood this from a very early age. He had lots of evidence that, you know, his children recognized him, wife, that was one of the times she appeared in his book. So clearly there's recognition. They recognize familiar toys. They recognize familiar situations. You know, they behave the same way when they see a toy. In fact, he even talks about a motor recognition. So there's a particular kind of rattle, which his daughter can shake and holds it up, and she starts shaking her hand in anticipation. He's quite happy with the fact that babies form memories and can recognize, all right? That's a sensory motor activity. There is stimulus, there's some event, some person out there. All they've got to do is make a match with information they've stored in memory. What he says they cannot do is retrieve that information, recall it, when the object or the event is no longer available to perception, okay? So if you think about all the examples he gives of mental representation, being able to imitate something that was seen a day earlier, that requires the ability to retrieve and recall that event and use that information to guide your behavior. It's not recognition, it's recall. Planning ahead requires the ability to think about things in the future which haven't actually happened. Think about what you would do. What would happen if you did something? What would happen if you pulled this cloth, removed this object, and so on? It hasn't happened yet. We're not talking about recognition. We're talking about generating new information, representing information. And that's an important distinction. Piaget accepted that recognition occurs. Okay? So he would be very happy with this sort of evidence we're seeing here. Perhaps not with evidence that babies display size constancy at birth, because he claimed that developed very slowly. But he was quite happy to accept that infants could recognize it. What he's saying is they cannot recall. They cannot mentally retrieve that information when there's no stimulus there in front of them. Okay, so that's the important distinction that he's making. Talks about the object concept, which is actually a big discovery. He talks about two aspects here. The ability to see objects in the visual world, see the units, and this research on object unity, and the Robin Block study is suggesting that babies are very responsive to common movements. They use movement in particular to identify where the objects are around them. And then we go on to the violation of expectation paradigm, and I gave you a demonstration. It's healed up nicely, so much better now. The big knitting needle through my arm, that was a violation of your expectations, and you all perked up and were quite excited. I was going to fall down, blood everywhere. That's a very nice technique, okay? So think about that technique, think about how it works, what you can tell from it, and we looked at a whole range of studies which demonstrated and used this technique to explore the early development of children understanding physical principles, such as solid objects, talked about in the arithmetic as well, the evidence that might suggest they just have some understanding of number, but I gave you an alternative explanation. And finally, I found there are some behavioural evidence, not just observational, not just babies looking, but babies acting, that they really do remember where objects are. And then we do intellectual attainment, which I already started. We moved on to the preschool years, and we looked at Piaget's ideas about what it is that's developing in the preschool years. He had two important claims, right? Remember these, which are important. This exam coming up in December, you may get a question on this. There's a change from figurative to operational thinking. Okay? So thinking is based very much on appearance, and then gets to the underlying logical principles. So there is a change of difference. And also that things can take a step back. Children don't understand the nature of their mental representations, the mental processes. They're confusing with reality. And they believe that everybody has the same representation, these sorts of errors in various situations. The Three Mountains task, there's a classic example of Piaget believing that the answers the kids give reveal their competence. Alright? So, the child is standing here, identifies the picture corresponding to her own view. Another person goes around to the side of the table, and the child picks the same picture. Piaget says, aha, egocentric. This kid really believes this person sees the model in exactly the same way, has the same representation. But now we recognize there's this performance competence difference, and we've seen in other tasks children don't display this egocentrism. Okay, so we know they have competence. And the explanation for Piaget's observation is this task was too difficult. It's extremely hard to work out what another viewpoint looks like. The child's got to match a three-dimensional model with two-dimensional pictures. There's, you know, left, right reversals. It's mentally a very challenging task. It's tough for some adults to carry out. So, you know, it's overloading the mental capacity of a six-year-old to display what they really know. So the child is just completely placed out and does one thing he knows, which is points to the one picture, one picture that he recognizes. And Piaget misinterprets that. You see confidence and not performance. And so we look at the evidence that children in fact do understand the representations. There are lots and lots of evidence here. Many examples. And yesterday we looked at a lot of thinking and evidence that Piaget's story again is missing their competence, that he's misinterpreting performance for the competence. We can demonstrate how the children do understand conservation, can reason, and as Margaret Dawson has put it very nicely, they frequently misunderstand the experimenters' questions and their intentions. And that's why this is the wrong answer. There's a self-exam question for you, okay? That frightens people a little bit, but just think about it. I've given you tons of information here. Okay, the short lectures that you've got, so I can't cover everything. But if you go through the presentation, okay, look at the examples I've given you, think about what I've said, and then read the relevant chapters in Yorkland, you will have all the information you need to answer these kinds of questions. So here's one. Is thinking and reasoning in preschool children dominated by surface appearance rather than less observable underlying features? Okay? So, there's a little hint about how you might approach that. Good starting point, Piaget. This is what Piaget said. Okay, so it's a really good introduction. Just explain what Piaget's view was. Figurative to operational thinking. What does he mean by those terms? Give a couple of examples. There are lots of examples to choose from. Conservation is a nice one. You know, a child basing judgments on the height of the level of liquid rather than the fact that it's got taller butt, it's got skinnier at the same time. reading the Constitution, the child paying attention to the subcategory and then ignoring the overall category. And there's lots of other examples as well, not from Piaget, who never made on the cap. That's a lovely illustration of this change in pre-relationship operational theory. And the appearance of the other class. There's lots of examples there that we can draw. And anyway, constructing your answer, you could discuss the new evidence that challenges Piaget's theory. And into that, I think you should try and weave this problem he has with the difference between competence and performance that I've been talking about today, which is really what is underpinning all of these examples. So, these are lots and lots of examples I've given you from the different aspects of development that you could draw on, kind of toolbox to draw on to answer this kind of question in the exam. Okay? I'll talk more about that. We're going to have a revision session. I can't remember exactly when. I think it's about week 8 or something like that. There'll be a Monday afternoon. It's entirely optional. But between now and then, the exam coming up, if you're reading through the material, if you're puzzled, if you want a bit more information, you'd like to run over something again, then come along and that will be a great opportunity to do just that sort of thing. And I'll talk about how you should approach questions. Just one final thing. I put a little evaluation survey onto Blackboard LED. So just click on that, and there are only 6 questions, okay? I'd like your comments just about my lectures, the information you've got in the handouts, my LED, and so on. It's always very useful to plan for changes next year. And if you have any comments or surveys, I'd welcome those. So, if you have been, thanks for listening. Enjoy the remainder of the module. I'll see you again for the revision session nearer the end of the semester, and also for the feedback session for the essay. Do you remember that? Good. Okay.